Most of the Wednesday evenings over, I'd say, close to a year of time here, I've been talking about the nature of awakening, what awakening actually is. And that's been probably the most common theme that we've been exploring here in these sittings. And some of you are here for the first time. Thank you for coming. And some of you may not have been here for a little while. For about the last 4 or 5, maybe getting close to 6 weeks now, we've been exploring a particular teaching from the Historical Buddha's archive. In fact, his very first teaching that he ever gave on the planet Earth. Teaching is the Four Noble Truths, which are set within another body of teaching which we've been looking at, which is the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. So just again, to kind of get us all together on the same page, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness have to do with what we directly pay attention to when we're meditating or living our lives, if we're actually interested in awakening, if we're interested in discovering our true potential, our true birthright, in one sense, our spiritual nature or our essence. If we're interested in that, there's a way to do it. It doesn't have to just be haphazard or by luck, although the energy, you might say, of grace is a real thing. And in fact, teachings of liberation or teachings of freedom exist because of the truth of love or the truth of grace. That's why they're here. Okay, teachings of freedom are here because of love, really. And that love is an unconditional love. It's not a love that's limited in any way. And so, if we're interested in awakening to what we really are, then there's a way to live our lives, you might say initially, a way to pay attention to our life so that this awakening can be realized. If we are not interested, then there's nothing wrong with that. We're not judging it. But if we're not interested, then we're interested in something else. Okay? Because most people are interested in something. I spoke with a person today who was very interested in not being bored, trying to figure out how to not be bored. It was an interesting thing to be interested in. Actually, inside that was, there was actually an inverted interest in boredom, you see, an aversion to being bored, because what you're in reaction to or what you're resisting, okay, you're actually inversively interested in. Okay, if you can just kind of step back a little bit and take a look at that, because that which you are avoiding comes and finds you. So, the teaching on the four foundations of mindfulness begins with the body itself, the most tangible object that we tend to call ourselves. Okay? And remember that awakening isn't so much about finding out who you are, it's about seeing through the veil, seeing through who you think you are, seeing through the identifications and the fixations with what and who you think you are. And as this happens, you could call it a process, as this process of seeing through what you are identified with, what you think you are, as this takes place, what naturally arises, sometimes initially just as a flash, is a glimpse, sometimes more than a glimpse, and finally a true realization of what you actually are. Okay? So we can all discover very, very quickly and immediately where we're identified. What you're identified with is what you tend to pay attention to over and over. Do you tend to pay attention to your thoughts a lot? Do you tend to pay attention to your feelings a lot? Do you tend to pay attention to your body? Are you concerned about the body? Do you have to have the body a certain way? Are you always working on having the body be this way or that, or adjusting the body? Are you aversive to pain when it arises in the body? Do you hold on to pleasure when it arises in the body? Do you fixate on particular states of mind? Or again, particular activities, because human beings get fixated and identified with certain activities. Okay, I actually have been sort of rediscovering the joy of vigorously working out. I used to do a lot of it, and then I completely let it go for, felt like, decades, and I started to kind of do it again without a whole lot of premeditation. And then I began to look into how there's many people who, if they have a real identification or fixation with an activity of, say, working out, and maybe they're very much of an athlete and even a professional, and they may be even being paid for this and so forth, it's their job. If they get injured and they can't do it, they often become incredibly depressed. There's a whole sort of biochemical change that happens. There's the identification with the activity and the idea that they have about themselves in that activity. And they really can collapse pretty severely and feel quite awful for a period of time until they realize that they're not what they do and they're not even who they have been thinking they are. So the awakening then is seen through the identification with the body in a limited sense, because clearly in one sense you might say the body is part of what we are. If you're fixated and identified upon this as who you are, then you feel actually, sometimes unbeknownst to yourself, imprisoned in the body. And the body is an experience of sensation, and it's an experience of breathing. Okay? And so the contemplation of the body begins to reveal the body as it truly is, not as a concept, and not even as an idea of who you are or what you are. It reveals itself directly as an energetic stream of sensation, of breath. And as this happens in any moment, there can be a realization that you are and you are not the body simultaneously. And in that there's a space that opens, you could call it the space of seeing clearly, or the space of, you could say, relative freedom. Okay, and it doesn't mean then that you stop caring for the body and don't, you know, bathe it and feed it and stuff. But those activities that we do every day with the body become much more free and enjoyable. And one isn't so uptight and concerned if it doesn't go the way one wants for the body. Okay, and it's, in that sense, it's actually kind of a byproduct to actually accurately contemplate the body, to see it for what it actually is. That's what contemplation is, to see this for what it actually is. Okay, now notice right now, in this room, for some of us, the identification of self as body. Just look at it. Don't try to get rid of it. Just look at it. Okay. And where is the identification of body as self? Where is that spatially? It's in here somewhere, right? It's not out there. It's in here. It's not in that body. That ain't my body. That's her body. This is my body. My body. This is my body. You see, right now, consider this. This thing was born, and this thing will die. This thing will stop functioning, but it's going to fall apart. It's going to dissolve. And if that's what you are, then that means you dissolve too. Into what? Particles? Nothingness? So there's a certain way in which the words that I share can only go up to a certain point of actually describing things. And there's going to be a place where it just falls off. And the words actually can't go into that space. And if you try to answer, your mind tries to answer what's in that space, you're actually going to fill in the space of freedom with a concept. An idea. And most ideas or concepts about the truth are ultimately quite unsatisfactory because they're just words. So you got an intellectual understanding of who you think you are. Big deal. Like how truly relieving of what ails you, or how satisfying is that to carry around ideas or belief systems about the truth? So the contemplation of body is the first foundation of mindfulness. As this is allowed to mature or to develop, naturally comes the second foundation, which is of the feelings. And in this sense, Buddhist psychology has three basic kinds of feelings: pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And these feelings are born from states of mind, from the food that you eat, from the fact that your senses are continually contacting their respective objects. Like right now, look at something, anything, another person, something in the room. Let the eyes look and see that there's a subtle feeling there. Okay, like for example, these eyes see that light back there in the kitchen, and there's a certain kind of pleasantness in the hue of that light that is subjective. Somebody else might look at that light and go, well, I don't find that particularly pleasant. That's kind of dull. Right? If my voice is working pretty good, you might find it to be pleasant. Someone else starts to hear a sound and they find the creaking of the chair to be unpleasant. See, this is feeling. Sense contact, feeling. Neutral is a little bit more subtle. It's like in between pleasant and unpleasant. There's a feeling that's neither pleasant nor unpleasant. It's neutral. Until our contemplation of the feelings is established or clear enough, we tend to be in a push-pull relationship with our feelings. We like the pleasant, we don't like the unpleasant, and we tend to kind of space out with the neutral. Sort of lose the focus and drift and fall asleep or whatever. What becomes clear in the contemplation of the feelings is that these feelings are coming and going. They're not solid, they're not fixed. Any story that your mind, thinking mind, ascribes to these feelings is usually based on history. It's based on something that's happened to you, so to speak. Past experiences that have been laid into, you could say, your mind. When you get real fresh with the nature of the feeling, it's very enlivening, whether the feeling is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Very live to feel the truth of feeling unfolding. And it becomes clear. You are this, and you're not this. You begin to see through the feeling, or in some language words, it's called beyond the feeling. You begin to see through or beyond the feeling. You, be careful about this. You begin to see beyond the feeling. There is actually no you that sees beyond the feeling. Yet, seeing beyond the feeling happens. And then the mind. In this case, the third foundation is the qualities of mind, and they speak of in the sutra. Sutra means talk or sermon. They speak of three particular qualities of mind that need to be known as they arise. The mind that craves, the mind that's aversive, and the deluded mind. And it needs to become clear, what is it like when these qualities of mind are not present? Because if we don't see through what are called the three roots of our difficulty, craving, aversion, and delusion, those forces will, to varying degrees, run our life. It's that simple. If you look at the world, you can see the world of humanity, that is now, this world, of the humans. Okay? When there's trouble, and there's a lot of it, and sometimes there's a lot of work on trying to resolve the trouble. That's what the address last night by the new president was about. Let's see if we can resolve the trouble. Where's that trouble coming from? Craving, aversion, and delusion. Buddha was so clear in his assessment of the situation, so scientific and rational about our plight, our individual and collective plight. And he gave a wonderful recipe, you might say grouping of recipes, for how to deal with this. So the contemplation of mind then opens into the contemplation of the dharmas, or what's called the mind objects. And this is where we've been the last few weeks here, for those of you who haven't been here, catching up a little. For those who've been here, pardon the review. Hopefully there's some newness in the review. No review is a good review unless it's got some new recapitulations in it. My favorite word from undergraduate school was when the teacher would say, let us recapitulate on the subject from last week. He never defined it. He never said what the recapitulation was. And I was always like, recapitulate? Yes, we're going to recapitulate. Can't wait to recapitulate. He said it every time. Let us recapitulate. It was his scholarly way of saying, let us review. The review needs to be alive, because when memory comes up, if memory is recognized as and only as that which is present now, not something that happened back there. There is no back there. I mean, there is this hearth.
Fireplace.
There is no past, except as something that arises in the so-called present. There is no future, except as something that arises in the now. Do you see this? This saves one a lot of trouble in terms of figuring oneself out, sorting oneself out. Let me get it all lined up. Got my past together in the suitcases or whatever. And then I've got my organization for the present. And not only that, but I know where I'm going. Right. There's where we want to go sometimes, and there's where we think we're going. And it's fine to have a plan. And it's fine to have a goal or a vision. But if you want to know who you really are, it's not about finding out something tomorrow. Or getting back to something that you once experienced. As sometimes happens for us, we touch something, it lays in or it opens out in such a way that we go, this is absolutely awesome. And then it changes. And if you're trying to recapitulate, in that sense, that which was, you are dragging around a corpse. One of the illuminations, one of the awakenings, is to see clearly that every single nuance of every single moment is absolutely new. Never happened before. See it. It's happening right now. Unequivocally. Simple to say, but actually quite stellar to get experientially. So the dharmas, the word dharma means the truth, the law, the way, has different meanings. It's a Sanskrit word. It also means liberation or freedom. In this case, the fourth foundation, you look at certain components in a more deep and, you might say, principled manner of your life experience. Okay, this is all about your direct life experience. Body, feeling, mind. Then you deal with the classic challenges that we face, which I've already mentioned in part under the foundation of the mind, what are called the hindrances, desire, aversion, restlessness, sleepiness, and doubt. When you're having trouble with your life, you're usually in one of these five. Desire, aversion, wanting what you don't have, not wanting what you do have, restlessness, agitation, sleepiness, dullness, which some people actually find a relief from the conscious state. They actually like to fall asleep because it's less painful there than it was when they were awake. It's interesting. And then, of course, doubting. Notice if the mind at any point has doubt in it. These look like your enemies, they look like your hindrances, they look like they're in the way, but what's happening in the contemplation of them is that they're seen as these very powerful forces, these conditioned forces that are in part connected to your biographical history, all the way back perhaps to your birth in utero, and in some cases people even have it open up prior to that. There is such a thing as seeing into a past life. People have these insights sometimes. Buddha talked about all of his past lives being completely open to him. He saw it all. Totally clear. It was all there. And nothing was shadowed. Everything was illuminated. He spoke very clearly about these things during his life. So these so-called hindrances become your friends. Initially they're your friends in disguise. Actually they feel like your enemies. That which you're trying to get through, trying to get past, not have. They don't care what you want. They come and they find you in the middle of the night. There's that desire, that restlessness, that aversion, the doubt. Until they're encountered and lovingly, kindly open to, they then can reveal their nature, which is the same as everything else. They arise and they pass. There's no solidity there. Wonderful. So I don't have to be working hard on having no desire anymore. I don't have to be working hard on not having aversion. Because when you're working hard on not having desire, now you're having a lot of desire to not have desire. I'm working hard on not being aversive. I don't want to have any hate or anger in my mind. Now you're putting anger and hate in your mind about the anger and the hate in your mind. And the same with the other ones. They are feisty and they're tricky. And just when you think, oh, I got it together now. I know what I'm doing. I'm okay. I've accepted myself. I'm resting on the plateau of my own present momentness. Nobody else notices, but I guess that's okay because I'm connected. I like myself. In fact, I love myself. Poof, goes away like every dream. And then people say, and it's been passed down from many people to many people, this waking state is a dream, no more or less than the dream state at night. Who are you? What are you in reality? And of course, this begins to move towards something that only words can point at, very, very clearly, only words can point at. The deathless. What is it that doesn't arise and pass? What is it that doesn't go away? What does the eternal or eternity mean, truly? So the good news in the awakening then, into the hindrances, is that they reveal that they too are not your problem. Contemplation moves on into what are called the five aggregates. Again, you see overlaps in these teachings. Five aggregates: body, feeling, mental formation, that's thoughts, perception, yeah, a new one, perception, and consciousness. And then contemplating the six sense bases. There's the eyes and their respective object, the ears and the sound, the nose and the smell, the tongue and the taste, the body, tangible sensations. And again, the mind comes in. The sixth sense base in Buddhist psychology is the mind itself. Interesting, the mind itself is a sense organ. Body workers hear that the connective tissue of the body is an organ, no more or less than the liver or the stomach or the pancreas. Interesting. Begin to open out into this sense that these things are all interconnected. Okay, what's actually happening here are this dancing stream of particles or waves, call it whatever you want, inseparable. That's all that's happening out here, my friends. Inside, outside, waves or particles, call it what you will. That begins to become clear experientially as this area here tends to relax, because oftentimes we're very identified with our heads. We're identified with what's going on inside our heads. We haven't contemplated the thinking process to see that it's actually empty. Empty of what? Empty of solidity. It's not solid up there. It doesn't mean you're an airhead, although you might feel sometimes like you are. And other people might say, now that's an airy thought. You're out there. But in the contemplation of these truths, body, feeling, mind, and dharmas, states arise, and they are the, you could say, preambles. They are the portals into the tastes of what awakening really is. I've already mentioned one of them, energy. Energy is what's happening here. All matter is energy. It's a false dichotomy to say spirit and matter. This is the spirit of things. This is the matter. This is what matters. This is the matter of the spirit. This is it, right now, how it's happening. Inseparable, ongoing, no moment outside. In other words, there isn't some other moment where something else is happening other than the matter of the spirit or the spirit of the matter. It's a false dichotomy to draw them apart. Because if you draw them apart, then where are you going to put the spirit? Very few people are going to go down there, back there, up the highway. No, it's going to go up because the mind's conditioned to view the higher, the better, the lofty, the godly, the noble, the truth. I mean, I like the sky too. I like to look up. But isn't it just as nice sometimes to just look straight down? To fall down? To lie down? To let the earth hold you? As it is to lift up and feel loss of gravity? And even weightlessness? So what happens then in these sublime, and you could say, as the teachings put it, factors of enlightenment, energy, investigation, an investigation that becomes increasingly free of bias and prejudice, so that everything that's happening becomes the awakening. Everything that's happening becomes the teaching. Everything that's happening is the living Dharma, living truth. Or in the more Hindu traditions, everything that's happening is darshan. Darshan means transmission. Darshan means connection with, conversation with the truth. Trees, dogs, cats, bushes, cars, the whole thing. Man, woman made, natural. Dichotomy falls away. And joy. A joy that doesn't need a particular object, doesn't need a particular experience. The joy born from unbiased investigation, unbiased contemplation, unprejudice. And one can become unprejudiced about the prejudice in one's mind. One can become non-judgmental about the judgment in one's mind. It's quite fascinating to see how that works. And the judgment unties itself. Why? Because everything in its nature is unfolding itself. That's what it means, partly. Liberation means, in part, everything is liberating itself. Everything is unfolding itself. Everything is arising and passing. That's its nature. Notice this right now. Whether the eyes are seeing, the ears are hearing, the nose is smelling, the tongue is tasting, the body is breathing, thoughts are arising, feelings are arising, sounds are arising, these hands are moving. It's all unfolding spontaneously. To that, we insert the idea that I am doing this, I am doing that. We're going to get to that in a moment. Hold that. Or don't hold that. Just let it go. So even to that, we have the idea we're going to let it go. I'm going to hold it, I'm going to let it go. Holding is happening by itself. Letting go happens by itself. There isn't anyone in here who lets go. The illusion is, I am having these experiences. I am having these experiences. This is the idea, deeply rooted, conditioned, more so for some of us than others. Some people's I sense or ego sense is very, very strong, such that it's the center and it must be the center. And when it slips off the center, it grabs itself and comes back into the center again. How arrogant. I am the center of the universe. In a second, less than a second, it can shift out and we feel the connectedness. We feel the camaraderie. We feel the Buddhist word sangha. We feel the community. We feel the togetherness. We feel the friendship. We feel the relaxation from higher and lower. It's like the umpire at third base goes, safe, as the guy slides in, safe. Being to feel safe in the connectedness, intimacy. So this joy okay, can get very, very strong in intensive meditation. For many of us, our joys are connected with having things happen a certain way. Sharing with others, fine, it's fine, it's fine. Pleasant experiences, it's fine. Somebody gives us something. My wife and I sent some money to our daughter in college. She wrote back with like seven whoas, W-H-O-A, with big exclamation. Hooah, 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 I can't believe it, you sent me money. It was like it made her day. She said she started making sounds and all of her roommates down the hall were like, what's going on down there in room seven? Alana's losing it. Money. Some joy. This kind of joy, though, that comes from the contemplation, it's more sublime. It actually isn't excited. It's tranquilizing. Once it settles, at first it can be a real burst. People get goose flesh, their hair stands up. They even smell like sandalwood. How about that? The natural smell of a human being when they're really touching their depth is sandalwood. You don't have to put any essential oil on. It's just sandalwood. Check it out sometime. Next time you're really having a burst of joy, just go like this. See if it hasn't just changed a little. I mean this. Just don't let anybody see you. And then you have these factors that balance those, because you can feel sort of energy, investigation, joy. Now you have tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. And the integrating or unifying factor is mindfulness. Mindfulness or awareness. Mindfulness or awareness is impermanent as is any other state. Out of these seven, I initially was taught, and I was taught very vigorously, almost militaristically, about the power of equanimity and mindfulness. I was taught if you practice these diligently, you will get enlightened. That's what I heard. Now, I can say to you, that's what I heard. I don't know whether that's what was being said. I wonder what you will think I said tonight. See, it gets translated. It's like that movie that Bill Murray was in translation. He's lost between cultures, sort of. But there's a translation process that happens. Through the filters of your mind, you hear things a certain way. That's perception that's doing that in part. And also your history. It conditions your mind to organize the present moment in a certain way. What happens is this becomes clear as you meditate. So now, these seven factors are very, very beautiful, but impermanent. They're tastes, they're preambles to freedom. They're relative states of freedom, they're sublime states. And then you have this teaching that we started last week, the Four Noble Truths. Buddha's first teaching. One, life is suffering. Two, there's a cause for the suffering. Three, there is emancipation, there is cessation of this suffering. Four, there's a way to live so that the first three noble truths become realized. We started in on this first. Jessica, someone who's typically here or sometimes here is not here, she and I had a conversation last week. She was very helpful for me around this first noble truth. She was doing some fairly focused contemplations herself on this. She had heard the talk last week on the first noble truth, and then she had some reflections and she shared them with me. She made a point. I think it's an incredibly important point. And it's very critical because we hear these words, life is suffering, and it sounds pejorative, negative, pessimistic. And even if we understand that that which we love we cannot keep, and that which we don't love or don't want still happens, and there is sorrow, lamentation, pain, and grief. This body is subject to disease and aging and eventually dying. And then the sutra goes on and it really nails something down that's hard for many people. Birth itself is suffering. Is this life negation? Does this mean let's not be born? And it throws us into a bit of a tizzy because so much we want the happiness and we want the celebration and we want the joy, we want the expansion, we want the upliftment. This sounds negative, dear Buddha. Why are you being so negative? Life denying. Why are you focusing on the pain? He's not focusing on the pain. He's focusing on the truth. And until you, as you perceive yourself, accept the truth of suffering, you will be imprisoned by it. And as soon as there's a shift into accepting that truth of suffering, however it's manifesting, wherever it's manifesting, whenever, and within whom, particularly within what you call yourself, you will be imprisoned. And you will not see suffering. You will not see life as suffering as a noble truth. You'll see it as an unwanted phenomenon. Because you're busy fighting with life. Am I making sense? Okay, I'm hitting it a little hard because it's so common over the years that I've been teaching, particularly these teachings, particularly the Noble Truths, for people to have a multitude of reactions to the First Noble Truth. The Buddha is saying not that the ultimate truth is life is suffering. He's saying life is suffering is an existential truth. Existential truth. If it's an ultimate truth, we're screwed. The best you could get would be Freud's interpretation. At the end of his life, he said the best you can get is normal human sadness. That's as high as it goes, or as good as it gets. And in his time, he was speaking to people in a way that was very radical. And he was helping people who were really stuck in all these hysterias and obsessions and compulsions. And he had revealed that there is an unconscious mind, yes. And you're being subject to this when you feel you've lost control and you're doing these things that you don't understand and you're hurting yourself. Yes, your unconscious mind. Of course, before he even had that insight in the meditative traditions, in the mystical lives of the mystics, they understood the unconscious. Thousands of years before, they appreciated the unconscious mind. That which is not yet conscious. Everything that arises, you could say, from this vantage point, is arising from the unconscious. If you don't like that word, call it superconscious. That means everything that's happening is already in potential. Or as Einstein said, life, right? Or energy cannot be created nor destroyed. It simply changes in form. The opposite of birth is death. Life, living, has no opposite. What is it that is living when the body is sound asleep? Something's living. Awakening has to do with seeing into, while in the body, you could say. I've already kind of suggested there, didn't I? I implied there's something beyond the body, a life beyond the body. We can't go theory here. We can't go with ideas and concepts. Forget it. And we can't go with somebody else's experience. Because that's just going to be concepts. And you can develop a blind faith about concepts and beliefs that make sense to you. But when push comes to shove, when you get down to the nitty-gritty, the existential truth of suffering is knocking. And it's knocking hard, firmly, vigorously, or gently. No theory. No theory truly relieves you. There are three marks of existence that you get very familiar with as you look directly at life. One, everything is changing. Everything is impermanent. Two, there is suffering, or in Buddhist language it's called dukkha. There is dukkha. There is unreliability. Yes, if everything is changing, then things are fundamentally unreliable. In what sense? Nothing brings a lasting happiness that is arising and passing. That's impermanent. And the third, which our minds have the most difficulty with, egolessness, selflessness, or in the Buddhist language, Pali language, it's anatta. There is no I or me to whom things are happening. There's a concept that there's an I or me. There's a concept that I am in here. There's a concept that I am the body or the feeling or the mind. That's a concept. That's an idea. Where is that reality? Can you prove it to me? Can you show me where the I or me is? No one can. Can't locate it. That tells us something right there. It's not the end of the contemplation, though, because we can be identified with consciousness. We can be identified with witnessing. We can be identified with mindfulness or some other state that feels central within this vastness. There's a centrality here, and usually it's inside the body somewhere. Some people are identified with their heart center more than their head center. That's just identification. Show me the I that's in there. Show me the me. See, these are descriptors. What happens is, as the truth or the existential fact of impermanence opens up, it becomes really, really clear how suffering works. And as it becomes really, really clear how suffering is working, it becomes very, very clear what's causing that suffering. Not as an idea, not as a concept, but as a direct experience. What is causing that suffering? What is causing the unhappiness in the human? And it's very clear. Craving. There's a, you can maybe sense it right now. Inside here somewhere, there's like this little or not so little contraction, this holding. You feel it in the body somewhere. Sometimes it's down in here, over here. Sometimes it's up here. And if you look deeply at that and you don't interfere, because that's what Vipassana meditation is non-interfering awareness. You look very closely at that and you don't waffle. You just face it down. You really look without judging. Inside that tension, that physical, emotional tension, there is this craving. It's almost like your hand. If you had a hand that could give a metaphor or an image of it, your hand is going like this. And the three kinds of craving, fundamentally. There's craving for pleasant experiences. We're not satisfied to just have a pleasant experience. We want more. And you can see it in subtle ways. Somebody serves up a wonderful dish of brownies. And they cut up the slices nice and even, and everybody gets one. There's three left. You have yours, and on a certain day, you have yours, and no thought about it anymore. Fine. Loved it. Thank you. Go home. On another day, or a different party, you look at that three that are left, and you want one. You want one. That's craving. And you laugh a little bit. We go, oh, that's no problem. That's just wanting more brownie. But what about this, my friends? What about if your last breath was going to happen at 9 o'clock tonight? That's 15 minutes from now. Last breath is coming. The mystery of a living eternity that transcends birth and death might be appearing. Of course, the Tibetans have done the research on the dying experience, and it can get a little raucous, like a little worse than a bad dream. depending on what's being carried there in the subconscious and unconscious mind, it can get pretty scary. And they get descriptive. Just read Sogyal Rinpoche's. He translated the Tibetan Book of the Dead, sort of, into the Tibetan Book of the Living and Dying. Feel the morphs, feel the shift. Instead of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, it's the Tibetan Book of the Living and Dying. And it's really interesting to look at this research. And this is experiential. This isn't somebody sitting around thinking about it. They're looking deeply in their contemplation, saying, what's really going on here? Last breath is coming at 9 o'clock tonight. Number one, you ready? Number two, what might arise? It might be a little bit different than just wanting another brownie. Unless the sense, the taste, the openness to the impermanence is clear and flowing, then what is there to hold on to? See, this is it. Because the third noble truth just got pointed at. There's nothing that needs to be held on to. There's nothing that needs to be avoided. And this, by the way, is the culmination of the Eightfold Path, which is the fourth noble truth, the way of living, so that the other three truths, the first three, become directly experientially clear. It has to do with your outer ethics, meaning don't hurt others, basically. Right action, right speech, right livelihood. Don't hurt others with your speech, don't hurt yourself with your speech, don't hurt others with your actions. Have a livelihood that's wholesome and good for life. Then you can contemplate, then you can meditate. You find out what right concentration, right mindfulness, and right effort are. Right means skillful, not right versus wrong. As these are practiced, what happens is your thoughts open, and the judgmental comparative thoughts, for periods of time at least, dissipate. And what happens in the actual conceptual mind, the cerebral cortex, is the thoughts are thoughts of love and generosity. I didn't know this was true and real until it happened. And these right thoughts, these skillful thoughts, these loving thoughts, and then into the next step, which is the right view. And I just described right view in a way. Right view is discovering that nothing need be added or taken away from what's happening here. And here is now, always. Nothing need be added, nothing need be taken away. In the Buddhist Pali language, it's called samma-samaditti, right view, correct seeing, accurate, true, direct, not deluded, direct perception. Let's turn just a couple more corners and then I want to hear from you. If you want to share, you can let me hear from you. The fundamental view that organizes the experience of separation and suffering is the view that I am a separate self to whom things are happening. I am sitting over here and you are sitting over there. I am this body-mind process. And out of that, we have all kinds of other configurations. I like this, I don't like that. I'm trying to be this way, I'm trying to be that way. Aversions and desires and so forth and so on. The whole game that I've described can unfold. Back up. Get prior to all that, and there's this absolute utter simplicity and this innocence of being that is unidentified with itself. It's just spacious presence. It has no agenda. It's childlike wonder. It's enlightened awareness. And there's no one who's having that. This is the central, very, very subtle and deeply conditioned tendency in the human until it's no longer there, is the view of separation. And from that view of separation, all of the various forms of suffering unfold. See, if there's nothing to protect and there's nothing to get, then there's nothing that need be defended. That means there's nothing that needs to continue to live. When nothing needs to continue to live, then everything is free to come and go, born and die. Interesting, isn't it? Living is dying. What happened to 8:30? What happened to the thoughts you had at 8 this morning or 7? What happened to fear if it came up at 3 p.m.? What happened to anything that you call the past? All that's left is the impression. If you have a very powerful experience in the so-called past, it leaves a powerful impression. So much so that the mind fixates around it, and it might feel unresolved. I was mistreated. I was misunderstood. I need to do this or do that. I need to work this out. This is in my mind. It won't let me go. I need to talk to them. So someone said to me today, I need to get that person to say what's true about what happened. She was talking about herself. What happened to her? She wants this other person to say, this is, you need to own up to it. Quite a dilemma. It's like getting your mother to say she was a jerk. Sometimes she will. But usually she comes to that on her own, not when you say, say it! You were out of it, weren't you? I'm attempting to communicate the immediacy of this, as contrasted to you're going to progress and do this, and then we'll see what happens. Now this is either alive and real and valuable and fresh right now, or it's just ideas. And I don't know about you, but I fell in love with ideas when I first realized what an idea was. These are fun things, ideas. But when the ideas about this truth of my own very personal anguish, which became very palpable and pointedly palpable as I realized that I really felt quite contracted and afraid and nervous and uncertain, and life seemed very uncontrollable at times, and yet wonderful at times, and it just kept moving like that, and eventually the ideas became less and less attractive, and I want to know what's true. I don't want an idea. See, for all of us, that desire to know, that seeking of an answer, it was the same seeking that the Buddha had as he set out from the palace and left that opulence and looked for that which no one could describe to him, no one could give him an answer. Maybe that's exactly perhaps what Jesus was doing out in the desert. We'll never know for sure. The theologians can't tell us. The journey of awakening, the journey of the heart, the journey to the center, call it what you will. So we've done a little bit more with the noble truths and actually touched a little bit through the second and third and fourth. It needs more care and attention, but I think I should pause for now and see what you have.